I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. I have a pleasure today to talk with Terry McMillan, doing our double duty here, both as host of the show, but also as a member of the board of the Enoch Pratt Central Library. Terry McMillan will be coming there this Sunday, September 12th at 2:30 p.m., and if you're listening to the sound of my voice right now down in D.C. or Montgomery County, Maryland, or Prince George's County, Maryland, you should head right over to Silver Spring to the Performing Arts Center at 7995 Georgia Avenue, where you can hear her speak and for her book signing right now. So as we speak, go over. And Terry McMillan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So this is a real pleasure. I mean, you're it's not often somebody can be both a popular writer and a serious writer. And sometimes people
I am flattered to hear you say that. You know, they often hold popularity against you, and they shorten it to pop fiction.
Right. As if there's no substance to it.
Like a pop quiz. But go ahead.
As if there's no substance to it.
I know, that's exactly what it means. And I we can just carry on.
I will.
I don't have to go there.
Oh, you might know. But we're talking about the new book, Getting to Happy, which is interesting for you. It's a sequel to Waiting to Exhale, but it's really kind of something different for you because you're not a sequel writer. I mean, you're not known as a sequel writer.
No, I'm not.
So how did this happen to you?
Well, after my last book and my last divorce, that was my first divorce, too. I sort of went through a really horrific period where I was blue, and I started noticing how many women around me were also blue and just sad or unhappy with their lives, and I started noticing the different reasons why. And so I said, you know, what I've gone through, I've never experienced this level of devastation or deception and betrayal. I just had not been there before. And then I decided that I would tell a story that sort of illustrated what it was like. And also, you know, there are a lot of women who are 45, 50, 55 years old who are lonely, who either have never been married, never had kids, or just bored to death. And I just thought how sad. You know, our lives aren't over at 50.
No.
And that somehow there are women out here who are very bitter and all this. And so I wanted to tell a story about, again, I ended up with four different scenarios. And then it dawned on me that I'd already written a book about four women, and I didn't want to repeat myself. And then I took another look and realized that these women from Waiting to Exhale happened to be the perfect candidates if I had given them a new life in which, you know, 15 years later, and they would be around this age. And I looked at where I'd left off with them, and it just seemed to fit. So I said, okay, let's try it.
And it seems to be working. I mean, I love the maturity that's coming to this. What happens, men or women, to us all over a period of 15 or 20 years, and how we change, and how our values change, how what we think is important begins to change, and that's
yes.
Really what you're wrestling with in all this.
Precisely, and thank you for saying it. You know, I think now that the book is out, all of one day,
right?
that people were. I don't know if a lot of women were hoping that it was going to be Waiting to Exhale 2,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, would have been impossible. I mean, if I had written it so that it started, you know, the day after the last one ended, maybe. But I was not, I found their lives back then pretty boring and bland, to be honest with you, and they seemed a little desperate. These women now, they've grown up. They've evolved and they've matured. So they're, like you said, their concerns and their problems and issues are not the same as they were when they were in their 30s.
There's something that you seem
Thank
to...
goodness.
Really, I mean, man or woman, who wants to be there for the rest of
I'm
your life?
I'm telling you.
You know? Stuff has to change. The thing that I've really struck me about your book, I've read all four of your novels. I'm in this one right now, but the other three. And your book is short stories. And one thing that you have, a couple of remarkable things I want to explore with you for a minute about how you approach this. One is that you really take from your own existence in life, but then turn it and listen to what other people are doing around you with your own experiences in creating things that, but that come are rooted in what you have breathed, have smelled, have felt, have walked from the very beginning.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, and people think, you know, what people misunderstand, they overestimate what autobiography means. And they think just because, you know, like it with Stella, everybody assumed because I ended up with a younger guy from Jamaica that everything in that book was true. And especially when it's written in first person, people have a tendency to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, not, at least 95% of what happened in that book was not true. It was fiction. And the same is true. You identify more or less with the emotions. You might identify with a situation, but really it's the emotions that I pay attention to. And then you fill in the blanks and by creating characters who can best explore these emotions and not so much exploit them, because I try not to write about, I don't write characters that are just puppets. That to me is a waste of time.
Though I guess it was your first husband, Leonard Welch, didn't think you were writing fiction once.
Oh, back then when he tried to sue me?
Yes.
Oh, but you know, some of these guys have a lot in common. You know, if they think there's a dollar they can make from it, you know, that's what seems to have happened. But a judge ruled that, guess what? Everything that I put in the book, he said, but, you know, but that's not true. This is what really happened. And then the judge said, you know what? That's why it's called fiction. You know, she tried to say I was a drunk. I'm not a drunk. Nobody said you were a drunk. You know, so it's ridiculous.
I remember that was, I know it wasn't funny at the moment when it was happening to you, but the result of it was kind of humorous. When the judge was basically saying, "You're not this person. What are you worried about?" And
I know.
Dismissed the suit. That was
he wanted to be that person, but didn't want to be that person.
And the other thing I have to ask you: have you, from childhood, been someone who hears dialogue, hears talking, and remembers it? Because you one of the things that makes your book stand out is you're one of those writers who can write the human interaction, create the dialogue, the vernacular of all kinds of people, and make it real. So is that something you've always had in your head?
No, not that I can remember. I mean, dialogue is one of my strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my only strength.
I don't think that's true.
But, you know, I just have always listened to how people talk. I mean, I lived in New York for years. I could tell the difference between, in Brooklyn, the difference between someone who lived in Flatbush, Canarsie, Coney Island, then in Queens, in the Bronx. I could just hear from the inflection. You can tell the difference. And the same is true, you know, people think that if you're from the South, but all that people are just have a Southern accent, but everybody in the South doesn't talk alike. All black people don't talk alike. All Jewish people don't talk alike.
Right.
You know, so you have to listen to how people say things, and I hear it. I'm not deliberately trying to mimic the language or the way people speak. I listen to how people talk and their enthusiasm or lack thereof and anger, and all of it is, I let them do the talking. I just am the conduit.
And you do, and you put it on the page. I mean, that's the things that makes your books hard to put down, because they're just so real. The people are real. These are not, they may be made up fictional characters, but the essence of who they are, we all know somebody like that.
Well, I hope so. I mean, the idea is to try to create characters that are, in fact, three-dimensional, that do ring true. Otherwise, I mean, I don't write fairy tales or two-dimensional characters. It's a waste of time. And to me, fiction is about telling stories about real-life characters who share real-life characteristics and traits and have the same kind of problems that we all do. And, you know, otherwise, where is the identification factor? And fiction is supposed to give you hope. And that's what I'm interested in, is how we get from A to D, and if possible, to F or G. But the bottom line is that we all have work to do to improve the quality of our lives. And we're always thrown a curveball, but my attitude is just because you're throwing a curveball, you know, doesn't mean you still can't hit the ball.
Right. You have to be in the you have to be in it.
You got to be in it, you know. And as long as you slide into home, what difference does it make as long as you get there?
That's right. No, absolutely. And one of the things I get a sense of this book is also talking about in a broader sense with all these characters, but especially some of them, Savannah and Robin, is kind of letting go of our self-deception.
You said self-deception?
Deception, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And the self-delusions about who we are, where we're going, what this guy means, what that woman means, or whatever that is.
This is so refreshing. You're the first person to say this.
Really?
You know, everybody's been so hung up on waiting to exhale and, you know, the women and what they did and how Bernadine caught the car on set the car on fire. This is so refreshing, and I have to say thank you.
Well, I appreciate that.
For acknowledging what rings true for me in this story. And you hit it on the head, and I thank you for that, because this is one of the reasons why I was trying to explain how what these women were dealing with when they were in their 30s. There are things about themselves they didn't even know.
Right.
Or they weren't even questioning yet. A lot of it was almost external. And this time they go a little bit inside. And that's one of the reasons why Savannah's marriage ends up, you know, having issues. It's not because her husband is a good guy.
Even
it's
if he's
not
a Republican.
Him. It's her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even though there's a little porn and stuff like that, you know, porn itself was not literally what you would call, I would call, a deal breaker. I think she used it as an excuse, because had she never discovered it, she never would have known about it. I mean, there are people that have real serious problems with all kinds of addictions, but I don't really think that was the case here. I think it was a straw that broke the camel's back. But, you know, and the fact that these women are willing to take risk on their own lives, I think more for Savannah and Bernadine, and I think for Gloria. But in some cases, you don't have a choice, and that's what I find. That's what I wanted to be able to do, because some people have said, one critic. Publishers Weekly, at least, said, oh, you know, she just gives them one problem after another. And I wanted to say, well, you know, welcome to the real world, honey.
Because it is
real. You know, as Roddy Doyle said, you know, life isn't all ha-ha and hee-hee. You have to get there. And, you know, things happen to us. We are, in fact, thrown curveballs. You know, your husband does come out of the closet and tells you, even though you were telling him you wanted a divorce anyway, he just happens to say, oh, by the way, I think I might be gay. And I'm like, oh, really? And, you know, you find out, you know, your mom just died suddenly. Or, you know, your kid just left home after 18 years and is gone off to college. You know, you never had that baby you thought you were going to have. Your clock has stopped ticking. So there are all kinds of things, and these women have had to, they lose their center, and then they have to figure out how to get it back. And I think all of us do, not just women, but men as well.
Oh, absolutely, men as well. But I think that with these women, one of the things that strikes me is that when you look at the human condition the way you do through these women's eyes, It's sometimes we think everything is in our control, and everything is not always in our control.
You think it certainly is not.
You know, because all these things come at you, like come at these women, as you just described with Savannah, and you end up doing things, and you don't even know you're doing them, and sometimes later you regret that you've done them because you didn't know what made you do it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just about life. It's about who we are.
That it is.
One of the things, this is a little digression from the book. I have to ask you this. I went on your website today just to see what was up there, and it's really a very good website. I like it a lot. But
thank you.
I really do. It's really good and really well laid out. But I hit the Solomon Welch button at the bottom of the site.
Oh.
A Song for Mama. I did. That was your son's a blues singer?
No, he plays acoustic guitar.
Okay.
And he wrote that song for me. He doesn't really sing, at least I don't think he does, but he's a guitarist, and that was 3 years ago.
Mm.
Did you like the song?
I loved it.
Me too. Thank you.
As a matter of fact, what I want to do is when we finish this interview, is at the end of the interview, I'm going to let that song play on the way out, if that's okay with you.
Oh, that would be so nice.
So people can hear it.
Oh, you're going to make me cry.
I love his work. He's great. Really good. So that, and I was thinking about that because because people often accuse you of being anti-man, anti-male. I mean, that happens a lot, I'm sure.
Oh, they call me a male basher. But, you know, I've had a few women call me or accuse me of being a male basher. But more, obviously, more men, but I haven't heard it in a long time.
Well, I was listening to, obviously, you have your son on the website, so I mean, my guess is you two are pretty close. Not to get into your business too much. but it's so, how would you describe him?
Well, you know what, the thing is this, is that my son, I think, is, he's a wonderful young man. He's 26. He's just graduated from Stanford with honors, and in 2006, he is independent. He doesn't share, obviously, my last name. When he went to Stanford, he had to fill out a form, and they asked, you know, what do your parents do? What does your mom do? And he told them I was a bartender in San Francisco. He stands on his own 2 feet. He refuses to accept any financial help from me.
Really?
Nope, he will not. And if he, I mean, really, and I just left his lovely apartment in Memphis, Tennessee, after having not seen him for 8 months. And let me tell you, it was a little spooky. No furniture. His bed was in the living room. But he has two beautiful guitars leaning up against the wall. And he works for Gibson Guitar, which is wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
But he knows what he's doing, and he's doing it his way. He has a lot of respect for women because he respects his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I raised him to be respectful, to respect himself, and to respect other people of all races, genders, everybody, not just women. And so he gets it. And, you know, I taught him manners, all kinds of things that children should be taught, I think. And so in all his life, people were always commending me. Oh, Terry, you've done such a great job. Oh, you know, he's such a well-mannered and well-behaved. He doesn't jump on the furniture. He takes his plate back to the sink when he sleeps over. How do you do that? Well, you know, you teach them. You teach them. And then they either realize that, you know, it's okay to be a good person.
And
I'm very proud to be his mother.
That's very cool. And the women in your latest book, You're Getting to Happy, they're teachers. I mean, they're teaching the ones that come after them, their children, their grandchildren.
Well, I would hope so. The bottom line is I think that as long as you don't do anything that's embarrassing or humiliating, then it puts you in a position where you can show. I mean, I get people all the time asking me, you know, how can I get my kids to read? And I said, well, you know, do they ever see you read?
Right.
Did you ever read to them?
Mm-hmm.
why don't you try that? You know, I used to have what I called the 15-minute club. I was an advocate. I still am. You read to your kids at least 15 minutes a day. And I did that with my son from the time he was a baby until one day he said, Mom, I want to read to you.
Wow.
And it was Goodnight Moon. And, of course, he knew it by heart. But he knew when to flip those pages. And now, you know, with these stupid things that, you know, your baby can't read or my baby can read. And I'm thinking, but why do they need to read at 2 years old? They can't even talk.
Right.
I mean, you know, who's going to quiz them? Why do they need to read when they're 9 months old? It's ridiculous. But I didn't mean to go off.
No, it's okay. That's fine. It makes it more interesting. I mean, because it's real. And I think that's part of what, obviously, we've never met, but you impart that as a human being, but you clearly impart that as a writer.
Well, I'll say this about the whole man-bashing thing. You know, Chekhov said that man will become better only once you make him see what he is like.
Right.
And I believe that. That's my motto. And, you know, people don't understand that bad behavior is much more interesting than good behavior. In fiction it is, you know, and it's about conflict. And as far as I'm concerned, most problems that women have stem from men. Men cause women a lot of grief. And, you know, the ones who seem to scream the loudest are the guiltiest.
So what is it about us, this gender of mine, that does that?
I didn't say all men.
I know you didn't say all men, but you said men cause, I mean, women's grief is caused by men. But what is that, do you think?
I said most of women's grief.
Most, right, most.
Yeah, because you guys don't cooperate, you know? And I think it's genetic, to be honest. I think that you guys are just wired a little differently. That the things that we just inherently and intuitively understand, it takes you guys a little longer to even get it. But some of you guys don't even want to work to figure it out. And that's why I think there are the differences between genders is so vast, you know. And that's why we are considered emotional beings, and I think men are a lot more pragmatic.
Well, it's interesting. I think
it makes our lives interesting. That's for sure.
It does that. You know, I mean, it's for a lot of men or women. I think one of the things this book, I mean, it doesn't just speak to women because I think it speaks to anybody who, as we talked about earlier in this conversation, that who you are at 20, 30, and 40 years old is not who you are at 50 and 60.
And that, I hope not.
Really? And that for some, it takes all of us time to mature. I mean, you know, and I think it is true that we men, by and large, don't listen or hear, and often don't listen or hear women until we get older. Then we start hearing it differently, I think.
Yes, but I also think that I don't know. I think in at least in this story. And even in my own life, and I have a lot of respect for men, and a lot of patience.
Mm-hmm.
I have had in the past. I don't think I have as much patience now as I once did.
Mm-hmm.
I just assume kick them to the curb and pick another number. but seriously, I think. It's just hard to realize that we have so much to gain by realizing that we're on the same team, that we pretty much want the same things, which is to feel loved and to be able to love someone unconditionally, as cliche as it may sound, and just, you know, do the best you can for yourself and for someone else, be it your husband, your girlfriend, your wife, your kids, and it just will improve the quality of all of our lives when you just, if you just think about it that way. And sometimes people just seem to, I don't know, thrive on the ugly stuff and make that loom a lot larger. And I just wish that we could do it the opposite.
Well, I mean, it's something about this book and these characters are wrestling with that, you know, whether it's their what each one of these women has to wrestle with in their own personal lives and what they
mm-hmm.
try to, how they each kind of mask what gives them pain in a different way and how they have to fight their way through that and I mean, I think that journey you're describing is a journey these characters are taking.
Well, I think it's a healthy one, because a lot of people don't question anything, and they don't, and their own behavior is one of the biggest ones. They just assume because they do it, it's okay, or because I feel like this, it's okay, and it's not. You know, we err. We judge things and people wrongly. We make mistakes, and to be able to own up to them doesn't mean that, you know, you are a bad person. But, you know, we all stray. We go through take these detours, and we make bad choices. We just do. And to own up to it is, to me, very humane and very, very grown up.
Mm-hmm.
And to also to try to do things a little differently when things you've tried in the past don't work for you. That, to me, is part of being a mature person. And also to do more things that you do know that do, in fact, give you pleasure and make you feel good. I'm not talking about robbing or anything like that. But, you know, I mean, a lot of people don't even know what they like. They just know what they don't like. And I think that I tried to get these characters to at least begin to question it because, you know, I don't like, you know, nice, neat, little happy endings where something that people are trying to strive for is that tangible and that they just get there and then, okay, now what? No, it's a process and it's really an evolution. And it's a journey, and you just stop the journey when they hit a certain plateau, just like in our lives.
Right.
And that's how I try to tell a story.
And you've done it this time. You really have done it this time.
Just, well, thank you.
For people of my age especially, I think. But it's good for anybody to read. I one quick last question. I'm just curious. Are you making a movie out of this one, too?
Well, I'm not making a movie out of it, but 20th Century Fox bought the movie right.
They did.
And I just, with a partner, a writing partner, her name is Lori Lakin Hutcherson, she and I just turned in the first draft yesterday.
Oh, very cool.
So, but that's just the first draft. We have to see what they have to say because they always have comments. Oh, Lord, do they have comments?
But you know they're going to do it.
Pardon?
You know they're going to do it, though.
Well, I think they'll probably do it.
You know, I mean, you know, they'd be fools not to. Is my girl Angela Bassett going to be in it again? I hope. She's one of the most.
Yes.
She's an incredible
Angela
actor.
For sure. All of them. We just aren't sure yet about Whitney, and we're crossing our fingers.
Mm-hmm.
But we still are a ways off. If they do anything, it'll be sometime next year.
Angela Bassett's one of those actors who needs to be seen more and is not seen enough because she's the most. I mean, I just one quick aside. I knew her back at Yale.
Oh.
In the old days when she first went to New York, and I have not seen her in maybe 20 years, maybe 15 years. It's the last time I saw her. But she, and it's always nice to see her again when we do run into each other, but she, I remember seeing her in a production in Yale where watching her on stage, this play, I don't even remember what the play was, it just brought me to my knees. I was literally on the floor. I mean, she's such an
mm-hmm.
amazing actor.
So mm-hmm.
And she
certainly is.
I want to see more of her. Anyway, we're not talking about her. We're talking about you. I'm sorry. It's just digression.
That's okay.
But
well, hopefully you'll see her in this. And if she plays Bernadine, she'll be able to do it again.
Yes, she will.
I'm serious.
Yes.
There will be no cars burning up. But there are some looks and things that she has to do in here hopefully will ring louder than a burning car.
Oh, I think they will. I mean, her character rings much louder in this one in much deeper ways.
Mm-hmm.
As they all do. Terry McMillan, this has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about Getting to Happy, and I look forward to meeting you in Baltimore.
I thank you. Please do introduce yourself and your wife.
We will.
And thank you for what you said about my son's song. I can't wait to tell him.
All right, we're going to put that right at the end of the show.
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate it. And your nice comments.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, you have a good afternoon.
You too. And we've been talking to Terry McMillan. And Terry McMillan, as you listen to her son under us here, you can see her tonight if you're driving around the D.C. Beltway. She's in Silver Spring at the Performing Arts Center, 7995 Georgia Avenue, till 9 o'clock tonight, so get over there. But Sunday, come up to Baltimore. We'll have a lot of fun at the Enoch Pratt Central Library, 2:30 in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon. She'll be there to give a talk, Q&A, signing her books, and get a chance to meet Terry McMillan in person. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.